The idea that Americans would march down the street, torches in hand, yelling, "Jews will not replace us," seems like something from a long ago time. But it was last year in Charlottesville, Virginia. When the white nationalist demonstrations and the counter demonstrations were over, one woman was dead and several people wounded after a car drove into a crowd. By then, even the people who poo-pooed the idea of a resurgence of racism in America might have been convinced. Our guest this hour got to work getting to know American racists several years before that. Vegas Tenold is the author of Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Vegas is Norwegian by birth, Brooklyn by residence, Columbia School of Journalism by training. His work has appeared in the New York Times and Rolling Stone, among others. National security, conflict, human rights, and the far right are the subjects he's covered. Vegas Tenold, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very fresh look at what has been going on in America for the last few years. Did you have the book locked up just before the events of Charlottesville?
Charlottesville is the last chapter of the book. It's sort of a postscript. I wasn't really planning on going, but I thought, you know, I'd been going to these rallies for so long, might as well get a last one in. So that's the final chapter, and it seemed fitting to end it there.
Wow. So what you thought was going to be the end of your experience with white nationalists kind of became the beginning for a lot of other Americans, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's people really, I think it was an eye-opener for a lot of people. And I think it really was a shot in the arm as well for the counter-protest movement.
You differentiate on the very first page between white racist and alt-right. What difference do you see there?
Well, the thing there is I have a fundamental problem with the term alt-right, and, you know, mostly because that's a term they themselves invented. That term was coined by Richard Spencer in 2008, but also because it implies that there is something new with the politics of the so-called alt-right. And, you know, while certainly their methods is new, we didn't used to have Twitter and we didn't used to have Reddit, then their politics and their ideology is very much the same brand of white nationalist politics we've seen for decades in this country. So I kind of take issue with the fact that it implies that it brings something new to the table.
Richard Spencer, you just mentioned, as the coiner of the term alt-right, and he pretty much comes up in any discussion of racism in America. Did you spend any time around him, though, for this book?
Yeah, I spent a good amount of time with Richard, and you know, he's a different kind of guy from a lot of the other people I spent time with. Most of the people in the book are, you know, the boots of the movement, the people who dress up in boots and the skinheads and the kind of rowdier bunch. But I mean, Richard Spencer has clearly been hugely influential and an important figure within the movement. It'll be interesting to see what he comes up with now that he's ended his college tour after the dismal turnout that he prompted.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. He was going to go on a speaking tour, and very few people showed up.
I think he spoke to like 12 people in a hall in Michigan or something. So,
wow.
Yeah. Which bodes well.
Even within the far right, there are several shades, for lack of a better term. I mean, you don't call them all Nazis, for example. Why?
Well, I thought for the purposes of this book, I wanted to be as specific as possible. I have no problem with people calling all kinds of nationalists. I have no problem with them calling them Nazis or white supremacists. But just for the purpose of this book, there are groups who identify as national socialists, i.e., you know, Hitler's politics from the 30s and 40s. There are groups who identify as mere nationalists. They have no sort of overarching ideology except that, you know, America should be white and we should have strong borders. There are groups such as the Klan who are very clearly white supremacist. It's in their very nature that they believe that the white race is better than any other groups. And, you know, you can argue that that's all semantics, but just for the sake of clarity in the book, I wanted to make that distinction because, you know, there are groups in the book who are actual literal Nazis from a technical standpoint, and I needed a way to differentiate that.
All right, that is fair, to make sure that they're being identified how they identify. Now, but you point out early in the book that you're not a neutral observer. I mean, you come from Norway, as we talked about. You're not going to be saying, though, that there are fine people on both sides. In Norway, was this sort of feeling alien to you, or at least when you moved here?
It kind of was, and I think it was alien for everyone. You know, I mean, in 2010, when I started covering this, Obama was 2 years into his first administration, and we were all feeling really good about that. And, you know, the extreme part of the political spectrum was the Tea Party. So I thought, you know, I came at this as this is a interesting and weird aberration. Why would anyone want to believe in, you know, arguably the most hated ideology in history? So to me, it was, I was curious about fringe movements. And then I went back to Norway that summer of 2011, which is, of course, when we had our tragic massacre, when a far-right extremist killed 77 of our very best and brightest young people. And to me, that really hit home the dangers of far-right ideology and the potential for violence inherent in this ideology. So I wanted to understand it. You know, I'm a Norwegian left-wing socialist, and I didn't try to hide that in any way when I spoke to these people. I just said, you know, we come from complete opposite ends of the political spectrum, but I want to try to understand.
I wonder how many questions were asked of you by the people you hung around. I mean, because they tend to walk around thinking that there's this European identity or culture, and there isn't just one, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing as well. We got into a lot of conversations about the European culture, and that kind of comes back to the whole sort of white pride versus black pride thing. Why can they say black pride when we can't say white pride? Why can't we take pride in our white culture? And, you know, my answer to that would always be that because there is no such thing as white culture. There is no such thing as a white European culture, and you can be proud of your heritage. I mean, I'm Norwegian. Look how well we did in the Winter Olympics. I'm super proud of that.
Yeah.
And if you're Greek or if you're Spanish or if you're French or if you're Swedish, go on and be really proud of that. But don't construct this common white ethnic cultural heritage just because you need something to base your you know, ideal ethno state on, because such a thing doesn't exist.
Vegas Ten Old, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. He spent several years hanging around white nationalists, and we'll begin to hear some of the stories that he got from his time among them. The book more or less begins on election night 2016. Surprises for everybody there. We'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. Vegas Ten Old, Everything You Love Will Burn, and your phone calls and emails back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Happy spring as of 9:15 this morning. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are talking about decidedly unspring-like topics here on the Jefferson Exchange at the moment. Everything You Love Will Burn is the book by Vegas Ten Old, a journalist, about his time spent among white nationalists in the United States, several years among them, and several different stripes of white nationalists. The book is subtitled Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your questions, your comments, your observations about racism in America today. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get into real specifics, let me ask a general question, Vegas. Did you emerge with some understanding of why these people feel this way?
I think there are a host of different reasons why people come at it. I mean, everything from, you know, economic disenfranchisement to lack of education to just plain old racism and bigotry. People come at this from all kinds of different angles. I think, you know, there are some commonalities. I mean, a lot of the more sort of extreme groups come from predominantly poor parts of the country, predominantly white parts of the country, or in somehow sort of economically depressed parts of the country. But, you know, there are outliers too. Richard Spencer is a very affluent individual who's highly educated. So I wouldn't say there's one type of person who's at, you know, at risk of falling under the thrall of far-right extremism. They really come in all sizes and colors. Well, not colors, perhaps.
Right, exactly. Yeah, just generally one color. Matthew Heimbach was your company on election night 2016. Why him?
Well, he became the main character of the book. I met Matthew Heimbach in 2013, I believe it was, when he was kind of a young, up-and-coming, fresh-faced nationalist, so to speak. He was called the affable new face of hate in America. And he had all these sort of new ideas about what white nationalism should be. I mean, among them, he wanted to purge the movement of any notion of white supremacy. He would say things like, the white race isn't better or worse than any other race. It's just my race, and I want to fight for it. And you know, by saying these things, he made himself some enemies on the far right. But he was an interesting guy, and he had this vision of uniting the far right. So he would travel to all these various disparate groups and talk to them and try to convince them. So I thought, well, that would be interesting for me too. So I'll just kind of piggyback with him and let him guide me through this. So on election night 2016, I'd known him for about 3 or 4 years, and it really just seemed like a natural place to be. You know, the election night was either going to be the apotheosis of the far right nationalist movement in America, or the dismal crumbling of all their hopes and dreams. And I was, of course, hoping for the latter, and they were pretty certain it was going to come to pass as well.
And again, you didn't hide where you came from and your own particular feelings about this. And they were kind of rough on you on election night, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, but that was kind of fine, because it was a rough night for me, and they saw this coming, and I didn't, and it was just that's the way it is. If I was going to be open with who I was and fight and argue and bicker, then I guess they have the right to use that against me as well.
I want to underscore that in case anybody's not understanding. You never went undercover. This was really just you saying, I want to learn more about you right from the get-go, and letting people know what your feelings were up front too.
Yeah, so I'm white and I'm bald, so I guess I could technically go undercover with these movements. But to me, that wasn't very, very interesting. I mean, for one, I wanted to be able to push back and really dig in. And you know, if I always had to hide who I was or my true motives, I mean, first of all, I don't think that's very fair to any subject. But second of all, I don't think I would get as good a story if I always had to sort of pretend to be someone else.
We were just talking about Matthew Heimbach as the affable, youthful face of hate in America. Does he think it's hate?
I mean, he doesn't think it's hate. But, I mean, I think if you ask pretty much anyone whether or not they're a hateful person, they're going to say no. You know, they have this mantra, stop the hate, separate, and they believe pretty much all the ills of society comes down to the fact that the different races can't play nice together, and they see it as just sort of a pragmatic, realistic take on society. I mean, of course, societal problems are of a completely different nature. It doesn't mean that, you know, whites and African Americans and Hispanics can't live together. We should. It's just, that's just the way they see it. So no, he doesn't see himself as a hateful person. I see his ideology come across as hateful. I see his ideology come across as brutally anti-Semitic and anti-woman and anti pretty much every form of multiculturalism, but he doesn't see it that way.
Vegas Ten Old, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, he spent a lot of time with white supremacist groups for his book Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Didn't have to wait long. Page 6, there it is, Cucked Republican. What is it with cucks and cuckservatives?
Well, so a cuck is someone, I guess, who has his wife, I mean, technically taken away from him or stolen.
So
by,
cuckold in the old sense, yeah.
Exactly. So I think by cuck they mean pretty much anyone who's been made into being like a servant of sorts. And they're, you know, when they talk about cucked Republicans, they talk about Republicans who aren't standing up for their interests, who are sort of bought and paid for in a sense. So it's just like a slur they throw out against everyone. I mean, it's just become this sort of catch-all thing for people who they believe are weak in some way. And it comes back to this very sort of rigid gender roles, traditionalist, alpha male, beta male kind of nonsense way of viewing the world.
Matthew Heimbach, again, the person you spent a lot of time with, including on election night 2016, and you described the physical surroundings in Paoli, Indiana. I imagine you saw a fair amount of down-on-the-luck towns around this part of the country.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I don't want to say that everyone who lives in a trailer or a trailer park turns into be a racist, and this certainly isn't poverty porn in any way. But, you know, I think there is a very good reason why a lot of these groups have a relatively strong following in this part of the country, and that is because it is, you know, it is a financially depressed part of the country, and it is a politically disenfranchised place to be in this country. And you know, the fact that this is a part of country that went overwhelmingly for Trump isn't to say that they're all racist. It just means that they haven't been served by kind of any previous administration, whether or not Democrat or Republican. So, you know, I think when the political establishment ignores these vast parts of America, they're doing it at their own peril.
Well, but you can see where some resentments would arise. I mean, you can certainly see that we'd get to, well, environmentalists killed my job, or globalists killed my job, or big business killed my job. How does it go from that to overt racism, though?
Well, I mean, you're kind of already there when you're using words like globalist, which I think is kind of the scary status quo we're finding ourselves in. I mean, globalist is just a euphemism for Jew, and this is the kind of language that was always used on the far right, but it's now, you know, even Trump used it the other day. So, you know, if you're at a place where you're saying things like globalist this and globalist that, you're already pretty much in white nationalist territory. But I mean, that's the fundamental problem we're faced with. I mean, because the reasons why people don't have jobs, or the reasons why the coal mines are closing down or the steel mills are closing down, are many faceted and very confounding and complicated. So if some populist or some demagogue comes along and says it's because of the Mexicans or it's because of the Jews, then that becomes a very tempting narrative to buy into, because the alternative is just too baffling to get your mind around.
Vegas Tenhold, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist who spent several years with white supremacist groups in America, out in the daylight, did not hide who he was or what he was doing or his own particular feelings, which are quite the opposite of what they feel. He ended up producing a book called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Let's get your thoughts on this. And what have you been thinking about the rise of white nationalism in America? Has it affected people you know? Has it affected you, even? We'd like to hear your story on the Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we mentioned Matthew Heimbach. You met about halfway through your time in this community. Let's go back to who was your first buddy in the movement?
So I started emailing whatever emails I could find online, and I posted on message board, you know, I'm a Norwegian journalist, I want to do this, I want to try to understand. And I didn't hear back for the longest time. It was just, the silence was deafening. Then 2 months into it, I got an email out of the blue from a guy called Duke Schneider, who introduced himself as the lieutenant of the SS in Brooklyn, and he said he would meet me. So we met a bunch of times, always in this very far flung part of Brooklyn where he lived, and he was extremely paranoid, of course. And you know, until I was finally invited to their annual convention in Trenton, New Jersey. So my first in with these guys was the NSM, which is the National Socialist Movement, which is, you know, the largest neo-Nazi group in the country, relatively speaking. They're not a large group by any stretch, but I guess they're the largest.
You let us know at the start of the book that you did not edit the language. I mean, some of this stuff must have been very hard to hear.
It was, but you know. Again, most of I'm a white guy, so their hatred and ire wasn't really aimed at me. So it was difficult to hear. It was difficult to write. But you know, I feel it's important that we don't moderate their language, because we need to recognize it for what it is, and for, you know, how kind of abhorrent that it is. So I didn't feel like it wasn't my job to take offense on behalf of others, but you know, I do recognize that it is hugely offensive.
Now, through Duke Schneider, you met Commander Jeff, is it Shep or Shoop?
Scoop.
Okay, Jeff Scoop.
Yeah.
Commander of what?
He is the commander of the NSM. Now, they're, as I said, they're a National Socialist group, so they like to assume ranks and roles that kind of have their parallels to Hitler's party or to the Third Reich. So, you know, he's the commander. You have the captains and the lieutenants and the sergeants and the stormtroopers and the SS and the Waffen. I mean, you have all kinds of things. They've been accused of sort of live role-playing, just playing dress-up, which is a pretty accurate description of what they do. They get dressed up in Nazi costumes and sort of parade around.
Wow. So, but he says that one of his points is, he says if he's a hater, then Martin Luther King was a hater. How does he find that logic?
Well, I mean, it's that whole false equivalency between, you know, why can you say black power when I can't say white power? Why can you say gay pride when I can't say straight pride? I mean, they just equate everything, and, you know, you don't need to go around saying white pride, because the white race has kind of been perched on the very top of the societal food chain forever to the detriment of everyone else. So it's kind of like an awful thing to go around to say white pride like this. It doesn't really make any sense at all. So, you know, to say that Martin Luther King was a hater when, you know, he was trying to bring his people out of this white supremacist system that they lived under, and they, you know, in many ways still do, is frankly ridiculous.
So given all the time you spent with various far-right groups, did you ever get a real sense of a consistent ideology, theology, logic?
They are pretty much scattered all over the map, which is why it's been so difficult to rally them under one banner. I would say if there's one overarching fundamental belief they had, and this was kind of surprising to me, is that they truly believe that the Jews or the globalists are running the world. In the sense that I think they almost believe that there's a back room somewhere where they gather. I don't know if it's biweekly or monthly or whatever, and basically plan out what's going to happen to the world. And they believe that everything kind of stems from that, whether or not it's immigration, whether it's trade policy. Everything stems from this sort of Jewish nefarious cabal that they believe is there. So I would say that's the thing that binds them together.
But you hear people, even highly educated people, say that, you know, rich people run the world. We just get to visit it. But they can do so without being racist, obviously. I mean, there's sort of a couple of steps down that pathway for a lot of people already, isn't there?
Well, I mean, rich people do run the world, but that doesn't mean they're all Jewish. I mean, that doesn't mean there's a common thread between everyone who runs the world. They're all Jewish. I would say that, yeah, we live in an oligarchical world where rich people have vastly more than the rest of us. But that doesn't mean there's one race or one type of person behind it all. Or there's any nefariousness behind it.
Okay. Vegas Tenold, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is Everything You Love Will Burn, about his years spent with white nationalist groups. So while you were hanging out with the NSM people, there was this event you call the Battle of Trenton. What happened?
Yeah, so the Battle of Trenton is a big deal, and that was my sort of introduction to the whole movement. We were out in an AA hall in a place called Pemberton, New Jersey, which is a small town in eastern New Jersey, I believe. And they were just kind of hanging around. It was their annual gala, and they hadn't seen each other for a long time. Most people only see each other once a year. So they were hanging around having lasagna and just talking. And when suddenly the door flew open, and this one guy called Gunner sort of just falls in, and he's screaming that there's an attack going on by the Reds, which is sort of their catch-all for, you know, communists or Antifas or whatever. And I was there, and I had my camera, and I was right by the door. So I was the first person out, and I just remember coming out into the parking lot, and I saw this group of people, you know, this black bloc, which is, you know, what Antifa is known as, just clad entirely in black with face masks, and some of them had sticks, and some of them had other stuff, and they just saw me coming out, and, you know, screamed, "Get him," which, again, I'm bald, and I came out of a skinhead rally, so I don't really blame them. But they threw a brick at my head that just barely missed, and this other photographer friend of mine came behind me and lifted me up by the seat of my pants and threw me under a car. And as I was lying there, I just kind of watched the Nazis and Antifa clash in this sort of, it was like something out of Braveheart, like just these two armies clashing in this brutal, brutal street brawl that sent a bunch of people to the hospital, and there was, you know, puddles of blood in the street and everything.
And the Nazis seem to relish getting into a fight, as if it's, you know, it's proof of their righteousness or something. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they see themselves as warriors fighting for their race. And they very much worship this sort of warrior myth. They have this whole like death or Valhalla thing, or, you know, I'll come home either on my own two feet or carried on my shield, and all this nonsense. And I do think that that's why, you know, the best thing to happen to the far right in recent years wasn't Donald Trump getting elected or anything like that. It was Richard Spencer getting punched, because that unified the groups in this real sense. They all felt like, okay, well, you know, despite our differences, We're all fighting Antifa now. So that really gave them a common shared goal, and it really, in their mind, cemented this idea that, you know, this is a war now.
Just a side note here, I wonder if you have any thoughts on spending time with Antifa people for your next book.
I mean, I'd love to. I've tried to reach out to them. They're harder to get into than the National Socialists, I think. I mean, I really want to talk to them. I think they do some amazing work. I mean, there's Richard Spencer said they were the reason that he canceled his college tour. I don't fully know that that's the whole reason, but I think they do important work in the sense that they're a key organizer in these massive protests. And, you know, by far, it's a very small faction of Antifa that engage in violence. Most of them just are really good protesters, which I highly respect.
Okay, I appreciate the distinction there between the people who do the violence and the not. Vegas Tenhold, our guest on The Exchange. His book is Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Your own thoughts welcome by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1:15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about racists in America, white nationalism, and its rise in the last few years, not just aided by the rise of Donald Trump, but by several other factors as well. Vegas Tenhold actually started spending time with white nationalists back around 2010 and watched the rise of Trump and other events take place as well alongside them, not undercover, let them know fully what he was doing and that he didn't agree with them, but that he wanted to know more about them. He ended up with a book called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your own thoughts, your own observations, your own experiences perhaps with white nationalist groups on either side. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I haven't asked about the significance of the title, Vegas.
So the title came about again on election night 2016. I don't know if you remember, there was a needle on the NewYorkTimes.com website that said, you know, that was pretty much firmly lodged on 95% Hillary was going to win. You know, all night, like we all thought, and I was watching that, and around 8 o'clock it started to dip until it just fully plummeted. And by, I think it was about 11, I had just kind of had enough. I didn't really feel like a journalist even anymore. I was just kind of bummed out. You know, my one consolation while covering these people was that their points of view would never get validated, or they would never get into power. And yet here we were. So at some point I just said, you know what, I'm going to leave. I don't want to be here anymore. And I got back to the hotel, went past the TVs and everything. Wisconsin still hadn't been called, so technically Hillary could still win it. I just didn't want to know. And I went to bed. And then at 3 a.m. that night, I get a text from Matthew Heimbach saying, you know, Wisconsin goes to Trump. Everything you love will burn. LOL, smiley face. So, you know, I thought, you know, life give you lemon, make lemonade. And I thought, at least I have a title.
Wow. Everything you love will burn. LOL, smiley face. That's an interesting combination of factors here. Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vegas Tenhold.
Good morning, gentlemen. I look forward to reading the book. I have a question, and this is something that I've observed, and certainly a lot of the critics or analysts of the various social movements have observed, is that they're like in the Black Power movement or other power movements, the position of women was quite subservient or almost non-existent, especially in terms of a public face. And I wondered, in various white power or white-affiliated movements, if there is any position of women in power, somewhat like the woman in who ran in France, etc., women in power within the groups, and if, is there an auxiliary? Or in other words, there's got to be family members and women who have similar views, so there must be an outlet for their views, not just through the men in these organizations.
All right. Thanks for the question, Connie.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Thanks for that, Connie. There are women in the movement. It's a very, very male-dominated movement, so there aren't any female leaders that I can think of. I mean, you have the Ann Coulters of the world, and I don't want to lump her in with these people. But I mean, they have a very traditional view on family and on gender. So while the men see themselves as, you know, the warriors who go out and defend their heritage and their civilization and their families and all that stuff, then to a large degree, the women kind of, they're in charge of, you know, having the white babies and kind of educating the white children about their roles in the world. Now, I mean, I'm painting with a fairly broad brush here. I've seen women in the movement who are, you know, just as much on the front lines as the men. You know, they face off against Antifa same as everyone else. But, you know, on the whole, I would say it is kind of their job to be the homemakers almost. But that's also an outcome of the fact that, you know, it's become much more violent and militaristic. I mean, the rallies now have this sort of battle edge to them. You know, you never know what's going to happen. You saw it in Charlottesville. So I think that's why as well you don't see as many women on the front lines, because it's becoming a very dangerous place.
Now, the indoctrination really starts at birth, and in fact, there's this story that would be funny if it weren't true, which is about this couple that their story, I believe, was that they got their kids taken away because they gave them names like Adolf Hitler and stuff like that.
Oh yeah. The Campbells of New Jersey. Yeah, they have their children. This was in 2011. Their children had been taken away by Child Protective Services because they had named their kids. They had two kids, a boy and a girl, and the boy's name was Adolf Hitler Campbell, and the girl's name was Aryan Nations Campbell. Now, this completely baffled the parents and the godmother as to why they would be taken away, because, you know, as far as they knew, Adolf was a perfectly good name, and most people didn't use the middle name Hitler anyway, so what was the problem? And as their godmother, whose name is Sandy, told me, kids are going to get teased anyway. She was called Sandy Koufax in school, which is clearly not the same thing, but it just goes to show that they really have some blinders on. Like, they don't see things in the way that, you know, I would argue most people see them.
Interesting that that Sandy got teased about being a Jewish pitcher. I wonder if that figures somehow in her ideology as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't thought of that. Yeah.
Need not go there. Let's go to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vegas Tenold, the author of Everything You Love Will Burn.
Yes, I'm wondering if perhaps the great majority of these people don't join these organizations because of their fear of their own personal inferiority.
That's a weighty thing to think about. Thanks for that, Mark. Vegas?
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing I've thought about, and obviously I'm not a trained psychologist, but I think there is a thing, you know, when you see these people buy into this warrior myth kind of thing, and I do believe there's a, you know, when you look at yourself in the mirror, you know, subconsciously you have a choice, you know, if you don't have much, if you're disenfranchised or broke or unemployed or on drugs or whatever, then, and you look at yourself in the mirror, you can either see a loser of sorts, or you can choose to see a great warrior. And, you know, it becomes very tempting to see the latter. And, you know, we all want to belong to something. And these groups, for everything else, they do provide a sense of belonging to people who maybe don't always have much.
Well, that leads us into a discussion of your first Klan rally and a fairly ragtag bunch you found there. Give us some description.
Well, my first Klan rally was this was in the fall of 2011, was with a group of the Klan group called the Loyal White Knights. They were out of North Carolina, and you know, they're a very, as you say, a ragtag bunch. They're kind of the first Klan group that any journalist goes to, which means that we really shouldn't pay attention to these guys anymore. I mean, the Klan is all kinds of different groups, but this group is led by a guy called Chris Barker, who will basically let any old journalist with a camera come in and take pictures of them. But as far as I know right now, the group basically consists of him and his wife. He's been exposed as a government informant, and people left, and you know, there was drinking at this rally, which really is a no-no according to Klan custom. So this is a bit of a, you know, it's not a very successful group, but you can say that for most Klan groups these days. They've really hit on hard times, and you know, I suspect they'll go away soon.
Was there any group that scared you more than any other?
I'm sorry?
Was there any group that scared you more than any other?
Well, yeah, just, you know, for my own feeling of safety, I spent a lot of time trying to get in with a group called the Hammerskins, which is a particularly violent strain of skinheads. They really don't have much in terms of politics. They just like to beat things into an unrecognizable pulp. And I was finally invited to tag along with Matthew. This was, I believe, 2 years ago. And when I got there, I was told that only the leader and a couple of other guys in the main leadership knew who I was and what I was doing there. So I didn't really feel safe walking around with a notepad or a recorder, because these are extremely violent guys. And at some point, a fight broke out between themselves. But, you know, as I stood there, I watched, you know, five or six of these hulking, looming, massive, muscle-bound neo-Nazis stomp on this other guy with steel-tipped boots until, you know, his jaw was broken, his eye looked like it had fallen out. He was just a bloody, bloody pulp. And that, you know, that didn't feel very safe. So I kind of stepped back from that one a little bit. But other than that, I'm a white guy. I'm not the guy they're out to get. You know, if there are, I have female friends who report on this, and I have African American colleagues who report on this, African American friends who report on this, and their risk calculation is far, far different from mine. So, you know, what they're doing is much, much braver than anything I did.
Vegas, when you started doing this work, it was about the time that the Tea Party was beginning to really get its feet under it and make a difference in American politics. Do you see the Tea Party as a vessel for the rise of the racists, and what pathways do they provide, if so?
Well, I think it just comes from the same wellspring. It stems from this sort of hatred of the elites, this sense of economic disenfranchisement, this sort of malaise where we don't like politicians anymore, or we don't like technocrats. It's because it's a confusing, baffling old world out there, and populism is popular. Populism is in vogue, not just in America, but all over the Western world. And whether it's the Tea Party, or it's the alt-right, or it's just neo-Nazis or the KKK, the sort of impetus in their path to power is the same, and it is this sort of hatred against the elites, against the against one's own situation.
Well, in a sense, then, they prove that they do have power, though, as people. They don't necessarily have to have it as racist people, though.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if their problem is that they feel that the elites have taken control away from them, they can rise up as voters and regular people and not have a racist component to it.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose that's true. But you need, I mean, to do that, you'll need a candidate to vote for, first of all, which is, you know, Europe has another system. Europe often has, well, many European countries have parliamentary systems, which gives you more of a plethora of parties to choose from. But here in America, you really only have two options. And the anti-establishment candidate in this election also happened to be the white nationalist, xenophobic, all foreigners are dangerous candidate. So, you know, it became kind of a catch-all.
Ultimately, Vegas, can you find a positive in all the racists emerging, in the sense that it's better to know that they're among us and we deal with them on that basis?
I think when we hear what they have to say, we recognize that their arguments aren't valid. that they can be defeated. And, you know, Richard Spencer just called off his tour because no one came to listen to him. Shortly after Charlottesville, there was a rally in Boston where I believe it was something like 12 white nationalists showed up and thousands of counter-protesters. So I think this is all sort of shown how easy and seductive, I don't want to sound all Star Wars-y here, but how seductive the far right and the dark side is. But I think it's mobilized a lot of people. People recognized all of a sudden that race is still a huge dividing factor in the politics of this country, and it's something that we need to work on. Just because we elected our first African American president didn't mean we were done with this. And I think Trump was and should be a huge, huge wake-up call for all of us.
Do the people who oppose white nationalists need to be careful about their own tactics? I mean, is there any sense that the tactics of the black bloc or the people who want white racists excluded from campuses end up doing some recruiting work for them?
I mean, I think so. I think obviously the tactics of Antifa in terms of mounting protests have worked. You've seen a complete almost stop in these big rallies because it's just too much hard work for the white nationalists to do them. But you know, I don't think violence works. I don't think anyone has ever had the racist beaten out of them. I think we should be careful what we call people. I think we should be, I fear that the kind of the center is going away and that we're turning into this place where you can't be a conservative anymore without people calling you a Nazi. I've met people on college campuses who've said, you know, I'm a conservative at a liberal school. People are going to call me a Nazi anyway, so I might as well join up with these people. So I don't like this sort of hardening of the fronts, this erasing of the middle ground that's happening. So we should be careful about that, but we should protest. We should make our voices and our opinions known, and that works.
It's a real compelling study. Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America, the work of Vegas Tenhold. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.